State of Matters Before the Reformation. Chapter 7. Third Preparation. Thus princes and people, living members of the church and theologians, were laboring each in their sphere to prepare the work which the 16th century was to accomplish. But the Reformation was destined to find another auxiliary in learning. The human mind was gaining strength. This circumstance alone would have wrought its emancipation. Let but a small seed fall near a time-eaten wall, and as the tree grows up, the wall will be overthrown. The Roman pontiff had constituted himself the guardian of the people, and his superior intelligence rendered this an easy task. For a long time he had kept them in a state of pupilage, but now they were breaking bounds on every side. This venerable guardianship, which derived its origin from the principles of eternal life and civilization that Rome had communicated to the barbarous nations, could no longer be exercised without opposition. A formidable antagonist had taken up his position against it in order to control it. The natural tendency of the human mind to expand, to examine, to learn, had given birth to this new power. Men's eyes were opened. They demanded a reason for each step taken by this long-venerated guide, under whose direction they had walked in silence, so long as their eyes were closed. The nations of modern Europe had passed the age of infancy. Their manhood was beginning. Their artless and credulous simplicity had given way to an inquiring spirit, to a reason impatient to fathom things to the very bottom. They asked what had been God's object in making a revelation to the world, and whether men had a right to set themselves up as mediators between God and their brethren. One thing only could have saved the church. This was to elevate itself still higher than the people. To be on a level with them was not sufficient. But men soon found, on the contrary, that she was much below them. She began to take a downward course, at the very time that they were ascending. When men began to soar towards the regions of intelligence, the priesthood was found engrossed in earthly pursuits and human interests. It is a phenomenon that has often been renewed in history. The eaglet's wings had grown, and there was no man whose hand could reach it and stay its flight. It was in Italy that the human mind first began to soar above the earth. The doctrines of the schoolmen and romantic poetry had never reigned undisturbed in that peninsula. Some faint recollections of antiquity had always remained in Italy, recollections that were revived in great strength towards the end of the Middle Ages, and which ere long communicated a fresh impulse to the human mind. Already in the 14th century had Dante and Petrarch revived the credit of the ancient Roman poets. At the same time the former placed the mightiest popes in his Inferno, and the second called with boldness for the primitive constitution of the church. At the beginning of the 15th century John of Ravenna taught the Latin literature with great renown at Padua and Florence, and Chrysaloras interpreted the masterpieces of Greece at Florence and at Pavia. While learning was thus issuing from the prisons in which it had been held captive in Europe, the East imparted fresh light to the West. The standard of Mahomet, planted on the walls of Constantinople in 1453, had driven its learned men into exile. They had carried the learning of Greece with them into Italy. The torch of the ancients rekindled the minds that had been for ages quenched in darkness. George of Trebizond, Argyropoulos, Bessarion, Lascaris, Chalcondylas, and many others inspired the West with their own love for Greece and its noble works of genius. The patriotism of the Italians was awakened, and there arose in Italy a great number of learned men, among whom shone Gasparino, Orispa, Aretino, Poggio, and Valla, who endeavored in like manner to restore the writers of ancient Rome to the honor they merited. There was at that period a great burst of light, and Rome was doomed to suffer by it. This passion for antiquity which took possession of the humanists shook in the most elevated minds their attachment to the church, for no man can serve two masters. At the same time the studies to which they devoted themselves placed at the disposition of these learned men a method entirely new and unknown to the schoolmen, of examining and judging the teaching of the church. Finding in the Bible, much more than in the works of theologians, the beauties that charmed them in the classic authors, the humanists were fully inclined to place the Bible above the doctors. They reformed the taste, and thus prepared the way for the reformation of the faith. These scholars, it is true, loudly protested that their studies did not strike at the faith of the church. Yet they attacked the schoolmen long before the reformers did and turned into ridicule those barbarians, those Teutons, who had existed but not lived. Some even proclaimed the doctrines of the gospel, and laid hands on what Rome held most dear. Dante, although adhering to many Romish doctrines, had already proclaimed the power of faith, as did the reformers. "It is true faith that renders us citizens of heaven," said he. "Faith according to the gospel is the principle of life. It is the spark that, spreading daily more and more, becomes a living flame, and shines on us, like a star in heaven. Without faith there is no good work, nor upright life, that can avail us. However great be the sin, the arms of divine grace are wider still, and embrace all who turn to God. The soul is not lost through the anathemas of the pontiff, and eternal love can still reach it, so long as hope retains her verdant blossom. From God alone, cometh our righteousness by faith." And speaking of the church, Dante exclaims, "O my bark, how deeply art thou laden! O Constantine, what mischief has been engendered, I will not say by thy conversion, but by that offering which the wealthy father then received from thee." Somewhat later, Laurentius Valla applied the study of antiquity to the opinions of the church. He denied the authenticity of the correspondence between Christ and King Abgar. He rejected the tradition of the drawing up of the Apostles' Creed, and sapped the foundation on which reposed the pretended donation of Constantine. Still, this great light which the study of antiquity threw out in the 15th century was calculated only to destroy. It could not build up. Neither Homer nor Virgil could save the church. The revival of learning, sciences, and arts was not the principle of the Reformation. The paganism of the poets, as it reappeared in Italy, rather confirmed the paganism of the heart. The skepticism of the followers of Aristotle, and the contempt for everything that did not appertain to philology, took possession of many literary men, and engendered an incredulity which, even while affecting submission to the church, attacked the most important truths of religion. Peter Pomponatius, the most distinguished representative of this impious tendency, publicly taught at Bologna and Padua that the immortality of the soul and the doctrine of providence were mere philosophical problems. John Francis Pico, nephew of Pico of Mirandola, speaks of one pope who did not believe in God, and of another who, having acknowledged to a friend his disbelief in the immortality of the soul, appeared to him one night after death, and said, "Alas! The eternal fire that is now consuming me makes me feel but too sensibly the immortality of soul which I had thought would die with the body." This may remind us of those remarkable words spoken, it is asserted, by Leo X to his secretary Bembo. "Every age knows how useful this fable of Christ has been to us and ours." Contemptible superstitions were attacked, but incredulity with its disdainful and mocking sneer was set up in their place. To laugh at everything, even at what was most holy, was the fashion and the badge of a free thinker. Religion was considered only as a means of governing the world. "I fear," said Erasmus in 1516, "that with the study of ancient literature, the olden paganism will reappear. It is true that then, as after the ridicule of the Augustan age, and as even in our days after the sneers of the last century, a new Platonism arose and attacked this rash skepticism, and sought, like the philosophy of the present times, to inspire a certain degree of respect for Christianity, and to rekindle a religious feeling in the heart. The Medici at Florence encouraged these efforts of the Platonists. But no merely philosophical religion can ever regenerate the church or the world. It may lose its strength in a kind of mystical enthusiasm, but as it is supercilious, and despises the preaching of the cross of Christ, pretending to see in the gospel doctrines little else but figures and symbols, incomprehensible to the majority of mankind, it will ever be powerless to reform and save." What then would have been the result, had real Christianity not reappeared in the world, and if faith had not once more filled all hearts with its own strength and holiness? The Reformation preserved both religion and society. If the Church of Rome had had God's glory and the welfare of the people at heart, she would have welcomed the Reformation with joy. But what was this to a Leo X? And yet a torch could not be lighted in Italy without its rays shining beyond the Alps. The affairs of the church kept up a continual intercourse between this peninsula and the other parts of Christendom. The barbarians felt ere long the superiority and superciliousness of the Italians, and began to be ashamed of their defects of language and of style. A few young noblemen, such as Dalberg, Langen, and Spiegelberg, burning with the desire of knowledge, visited Italy, and brought back to Germany and imparted to their friends the learning, the grammar, and the classic authors they so much desired. Soon there appeared a man of distinguished talents, Rodolf Agricola, whose learning and genius won for him as great veneration as if he had lived in the age of Augustus or of Pericles. The ardor of his mind and the fatigues of the school wore him out in a few years, but in the intercourse of private life he had trained up noble disciples, who carried their master's zeal over all Germany. Often when assembled around him had they deplored the darkness of the church, and asked why St. Paul so frequently repeats that men are justified by faith and not by works. At the feet of these new teachers was soon gathered a youthful but rude band of scholars, living upon alms, studying without books, and who, divided into societies of priests of Bacchus, archviziers, and others, passed in disorderly troops from town to town, and from school to school. No matter. These strange companies were the beginning of a literary public. Gradually the masterpieces of antiquity issued from the German presses and supplanted the schoolmen, and the art of printing, discovered at Mainz in 1440, multiplied the voices that boldly remonstrated against the corruptions of the church, and those not less powerful, which invited the human mind into new paths of inquiry. The study of ancient literature produced very different effects in Germany from those which followed it in Italy and in France. It was there combined with faith. The Germans immediately looked for the advantage that might accrue to religion from these new literary pursuits. What had produced in Italian minds little more than a minute and barren refinement of the understanding, pervaded the whole being of the Germans, warmed their hearts, and prepared them for a brighter light. The first restorers of learning in Italy and in France were remarkable for their levity, and frequently also for their immorality. Their successors in Germany, animated by a serious feeling, zealously went in search of truth. Italy, offering up her incense to literature and profane learning, beheld the rise of a skeptical opposition. Germany, occupied with deep theological questions, and thrown back upon herself, saw the rise of an opposition based on faith. In the one country the foundations of the church were undermined, in the other they were reestablished on their true basis. A remarkable society was formed in the empire, composed of liberal, generous-minded, and learned men, who counted princes among their number, and who endeavored to make learning profitable to religion. Some brought to their studies the humble faith of children. Others, an enlightened and penetrating intellect, inclined perhaps to overstep the bounds of legitimate freedom and criticism, yet both contributed to clear the entrance of the temple from the superstitions that had encumbered it. The monkish theologians perceived their danger, and began to clamor against these very studies which they had tolerated in Italy and France, because they had there gone hand in hand with frivolity and profligacy. A conspiracy was formed amongst them against literature and science, for behind them faith was seen advancing. A monk, cautioning a person against the heresies of Erasmus, was asked in what they consisted. He acknowledged that he had not read the work of which he was speaking, and could only say that it was written in too pure Latinity. The disciples of learning and the scholastic divines soon came to open war. The latter beheld with alarm the movement that was taking place in the realms of intellect, and thought that immobility and darkness would be the surest guardians of the church. It was to save Rome that they opposed the revival of letters, but in this they contributed to its fall. Rome herself had a great share in producing this result. Momentarily led astray under the pontificate of Leo X, she deserted her old friends, and clasped her young adversaries in her arms. Popery and learning formed an alliance that seemed likely to dissolve the union between the monastic orders and the hierarchy. The popes did not at the first glance perceive that what they had taken for a plaything was in reality a sword that might cause their death. In like manner, during the last century, princes were seen welcoming to their courts political and philosophical principles which, had they yielded to all their influences, would have overturned their thrones. Such an alliance was not of long duration. Learning went forward, without a care as to what might endanger the power of its patron. The monks and schoolmen were well aware that to desert the Pope would be to abandon themselves, and the Pope, notwithstanding the brief patronage he accorded to the fine arts, was not less active, when he saw the danger, in taking measures the most contrary to the spirit of the times. The universities defended themselves, as best they could, against the intrusion of this new light. Regius was expelled from Cologne, Celts from Leipzig, and Hermann von dem Busch from Rostock. Still the new doctors, and the ancient classics with them, gradually established themselves, and frequently with the aid of the ruling princes, in these superior academies. In despite of the schoolmen, societies of grammarians and of poets were soon formed in them. Everything was to be converted into Greek and Latin, even to their very names. How could the admirers of Sophocles and of Virgil be known by such barbarous appellations as Krachenberger of Schwarzerd? At the same time, a spirit of independence spread through the universities. The students were no longer seen in seminarist fashion, with their books under their arms, walking demurely, respectfully, and with downcast eyes, behind their masters. The petulance of Martial and of Ovid had passed into these new disciples of the Muses. They hailed with transport the ridicule heaped on the dialectic theologians, and the heads of the literary movement were sometimes accused of favoring, and even of exciting, the disorderly proceedings of the scholars. Thus a new world, sprung out of antiquity, had arisen in the midst of the world of the Middle Ages. The two parties could not avoid coming to blows. Struggle was at hand. It was the mildest champion of literature, an old man drawing near the close of his peaceful career, who was to begin the conflict. In order that the truth might prove triumphant, it was necessary first that the weapons by which she was to conquer should be brought forth from the arsenals where they had lain buried for ages. These weapons were the holy scriptures of the Old and New Testament. It was necessary to revive in Christendom the love and the study of sacred Greek and Hebrew learning. The man whom the providence of God selected for this task was named John Reuchlin. The sweet voice of a child had been remarked in the choir of the church at Pforzheim, and had attracted the notice of the Margrave of Baden. It was that of John Reuchlin, a boy of agreeable manners and lively disposition, the son of a worthy burgess of that town. The Margrave soon showed him a special favor, and made choice of him in 1473 to accompany his son Frederick to the University of Paris. The son of the usher of Pforzheim, in transports of joy, arrived with the prince at this school, then the most celebrated of the West. Here he found the Spartan Hermonymos and John Wessel, the light of the world, and had now an opportunity of studying Greek and Hebrew under able masters, of which languages there was at that time no professor in Germany, and of which he was one day to be the restorer in the home of the Reformation. The young and indigent German transcribed for richer students the rhapsodies of Homer, and the orations of Isocrates, gaining thus the means of prosecuting his own studies and of purchasing books. But he heard other things from the mouth of Wessel that made a deep impression on his mind. The popes may err. All human satisfactions are blasphemy against Christ, who has reconciled and completely justified the human race. To God alone belongs the power of giving plenary absolution. It is not necessary to confess our sins to the priest. There is no purgatory unless it be God himself, who is a devouring fire, and who cleans death from all impurity. Reuchlin had barely attained the age of 20 years, when he taught philosophy in Greek and Latin at Basel, and what then passed for a miracle, a German was heard speaking Greek. The partisans of Rome began to feel uneasy, when they saw these generous spirits searching into the ancient treasures. "The Romans make wry faces," said Reuchlin, "and cry out, pretending that all these literary pursuits are contrary to the Romish piety, because the Greeks are schismatics. Oh, what toil and suffering must be undergone to restore wisdom and learning to Germany!" Not long after, Eberhard of Wurttemberg invited Reuchlin to Tübingen to adorn that rising university. In, he took him with him into Italy. Calcondilas, Orispa, and John Pico of Mirandola were his friends and companions at Florence. At Rome, when Eberhard had a solemn audience of the Pope, surrounded by his cardinals, Reuchlin delivered an address in such pure and elegant Latinity that the assembly, who expected nothing of the kind from a barbarous German, was filled with astonishment, and the pontiff exclaimed, "This man certainly deserves to rank with the best orators of France and Italy." 10 years later, Reuchlin was compelled to take refuge at Heidelberg, at the court of the Elector Philip, to escape the vengeance of Eberhard's successor. Philip, in conjunction with John of Dalberg, Bishop of Worms, his friend and chancellor, endeavored to diffuse the light that was beginning to dawn in every part of Germany. Dalberg had founded a library, which was open to all the learned. On this new stage, Reuchlin made great efforts to destroy the barbarism of his countrymen. Having been sent by the Elector in 1498 on an important mission to Rome, he employed all the time and money he could spare, either in improving himself in the Hebrew language under the learned Israelite, Abdias Sforna, or in purchasing all the Greek and Hebrew manuscripts he could find, with a view of employing them as so many torches to increase in his own country the light which was already beginning to appear. Argyropoulos, an illustrious Greek, was then at Rome explaining to a numerous auditory the ancient marvels of his national literature. The learned ambassador proceeded with his attendants to the hall where this doctor was lecturing, and on his entrance saluted the master, and deplored the misfortunes of Greece, then expiring under the blows of the Ottomans. The astonished scholar asked his visitor, "Where do you come from, and do you understand Greek?" Reuchlin answered, "I am a German, and I am not entirely ignorant of your language." At the request of Argyropoulos, he read and explained a passage from Thucydides, which the professor happened to have before him. Upon this Argyropoulos, struck with astonishment and grief, exclaimed, "Alas! Alas! The fugitive and exiled Greece has gone to hide herself beyond the Alps." It was thus that the sons of barbarous Germany and of ancient and learned Greece met in the palaces of Rome. Thus the East and the West embraced in this resort of the world, and the one poured into the lap of the other those intellectual treasures which it had snatched from the barbarism of the Ottomans. God, whenever his plans require it, brings together in an instant, by some great catastrophe, the things which seemed destined to remain forever separated. Reuchlin, on his return to Germany, was able to take up his residence again at Wurttemberg. It was at this time he accomplished those labors that were so useful to Luther and to the Reformation. This man, who, as Count Palatine, occupied a distinguished place in the empire, and who, as philosopher, contributed to lower Aristotle and exalt Plato, drew up a Latin dictionary which superseded those of the schoolmen, wrote a Greek grammar which greatly facilitated the study of that language, translated and explained the penitential Psalms, corrected the Vulgate, and which is his chief merit and glory, was the first to publish in Germany a Hebrew grammar and dictionary. Reuchlin by this labor reopened the long-sealed books of the Old Covenant, and thus raised, as he says himself, a monument more durable than brass. But Reuchlin endeavored to promote the cause to truth as much by his life as by his writings. By his lofty stature, his commanding person, and his engaging address, he immediately gained the confidence of all with whom he had to deal. His thirst for knowledge was only equaled by his zeal in communicating what he had learnt. He spared neither money nor labor to introduce into Germany the editions of the classic writers as they issued from the Italian presses, and thus the usher's son did more to enlighten his fellow countrymen than rich corporations or mighty princes. His influence over youth was very extensive, and who can estimate all that the Reformation owes to him in that respect? We will mention only one instance. His cousin, a young man, the son of a skillful and celebrated armorer named Schwarzerd, came to reside with his sister Elizabeth, in order to study under his direction. Reuchlin, delighted at beholding the genius and industry of his youthful scholar, adopted him as his son. Good advice, presence of books, example, nothing was spared to make his relative useful to the church and to his country. He was charmed at seeing the work prosper under his eyes, and finding the German name of Schwarzer too harsh, he translated it into Greek, according to the fashion of the times, and named the young student Melanchthon. This was the illustrious friend of Luther. But grammatical studies could not satisfy Reuchlin. Imitating his Jewish teachers, he began to study the mystic meaning of the word. "God is a spirit," said he. "The word is a breath, man breathes, God is the word. The names which he has given to himself are an echo of eternity." He thought with the Kabbalists that man can ascend from symbol to symbol, and from form to the last and purest of all forms, to that which regulates the kingdom of the spirit. While Reuchlin was bewildering himself in these peaceful and abstract researches, the hostility of the schoolmen, suddenly and very much against his will, forced him into a violent contest that was one of the preludes to the Reformation. There dwelt at Cologne one Pfefferkorn, a baptized rabbi, and intimately connected with the Inquisitor Hochstraten. This man and the Dominican solicited and obtained from the Emperor Maximilian, perhaps with very good intentions, an order by virtue of which the Jews were to bring all their Hebrew books, the Bible only excepted, to the town hall of the place in which they resided. Here these writings were to be burnt. The motive put forward was that they were full of blasphemies against Jesus Christ. It must be acknowledged they were at least full of absurdities, and that the Jews themselves would have been no great losers by the proposed measure. The emperor invited Reuchlin to give his opinion upon these works. The learned doctor particularly singled out the books written against Christianity, leaving them to their destined fate, but he endeavored to save the rest. "The best way to convert the Israelites," added he, would be to establish two professors of the Hebrew language in each university, who should teach the theologians to read the Bible in Hebrew, and thus to refute the Jewish doctors. In consequence of this advice, the Jews had their books restored to them. The proselyte and the inquisitor, like hungry ravens who see their prey escaping them, raised a furious clamor. They picked out different passages from Reuchlin's work, perverted their meaning, declared the author a heretic, accused him of a secret inclination to Judaism, and threatened him with the dungeons of the Inquisition. Reuchlin at first gave way to alarm, but as these men became daily more insolent and prescribed disgraceful conditions, he published in 1513 a defense against his Cologne slanderers, in which he described the whole party in the liveliest colors. The Dominicans swore to be avenged, and hoped by a stroke of authority to uphold their tottering power. Hochstraten had a tribunal formed at Mentz against Reuchlin, and the writings of this learned man were committed to the flames. Then the innovators, the masters and disciples of the new school, feeling themselves all attacked in the person of Reuchlin, rose up like one man. The times were changed. Germany and literature were not Spain and the Inquisition. This great literary movement had called a public opinion into existence. Even the superior clergy were almost entirely gained over to it. Reuchlin appealed to Leo X. This pope, who was no friend to the ignorant and fanatical monks, referred the whole matter to the Bishop of Spires, who declared Reuchlin innocent and condemned the monks to pay the expenses of the investigation. The Dominicans, those stanch supporters of the papacy, had recourse in their exasperation to the infallible decrees of Rome, and Leo X, not knowing how to act between these two hostile powers, issued a mandate de supersedendo. This union of learning with faith is one of the features of the Reformation, and distinguished it both from the establishment of Christianity and from the religious revivals of the present day. The Christians contemporary with the apostles had against them all the refinement of their age, and with very few exceptions, it is the same with those of our times. The majority of learned men were with the reformers. Even public opinion was favorable to them. The work thus gained in extent, but perhaps it lost in depth. Luther, acknowledging all that Reuchlin had done, wrote to him shortly after his victory over the Dominicans, "The Lord has been at work in you, that the light of Holy Scripture might begin to shine in that Germany where for so many ages, alas, it was not only stifled but entirely extinct."